if I can develop from you, I think you and I are very much alike in the sense that in order to fight for our rights, we have to learn our history.
Yeah.
And our principles on the basis of which we take our stand and on the basis of which we sympathize with all peoples of all lands. What I find your experience very interesting. I did not know of this delegation that visited London. As you know also, there are treaties signed in Atlantic Canada between the Mi'kmaq, the Maliseet, and the Passamaquoddy, and the British. And these were treaties of peace and friendship. Mm-hmm. As you know, recently the Supreme Court of Canada upheld the prosecution of Joshua Bernard on a case of logging on Crown land. And basically, the Supreme Court of Canada has ruled that these treaties of peace and friendship were actually surrender treaties. That is, the British did not, although formally they signed these agreements, they did not look at the First Nations as sovereign peoples. You quoted the Queen, and she talked about her children. So this exemplifies this Eurocentric concept. We're dealing here with the problem of the state. What Tony calls decolonization, I call, is more properly called neo-colonialization or neo-colonialism, where these states are formed to carry out the colonial and imperial not only rule, but exploitation on a new basis, to take into account the rising national movements of people to reclaim their lands. Tony mentioned that there's a difference between what took place in India and what took place in Canada. And many people in Palestine or from Palestine think that there's a difference between the problems that they're faced with, which are monumental, and the problems of Canada and the problems of the indigenous peoples in Canada. But in essence, these are the same. So if I can go back in history, we can see the parallels a little bit more. I finished in my introduction at 1921 when the colonial mandate of Palestine was established. This itself was in violation of international law. That is, that Britain was given a mandate under the League of Nations to rule an area of the world that they had not acquired, that they had acquired by force. At this time, it's important to look at the policy that was adopted by the Britain. Because Britain is a small country, and it's in a way kind of a marvel how a small country, an island of about 8 million people, could conquer half the world. They adopted the policy, the well-known policy of divide and rule. So in 1921, the British Army gave evidence to an international inquiry called the King Crane Commission that in order to rule Palestine under the United Nations colonial mandate, they would require 20,000 British regular troops. The British Empire did not have 20,000 additional surplus troops. What was the problem that Britain was faced with? They're faced with the rising movement in Ireland, which culminated in the independence of the Free State of Ireland, that is now known the Republic of Ireland. And they also were faced with the rising movement within India, what they called the jewel in the British crown. So the policy which is adopted in terms of divide and rule is to set people at their throats, at each other's throats, to set people at loggerheads. That is, to inflame or create an institutional basis for sectarianism, for division of the people on a religious basis, and for the violation of the rights of nations and national minorities. Okay? You can see this in Africa. In Africa, there's about 3,000 distinct national kingdoms. But there's about 50 to 60 countries. So these states are created without regard to the First Nations of these distinct regions. And this is what was adopted in India, was a policy of sectarianism, of communal violence, such that the period that India goes through from 1920 to so-called independence of in 1948 is a period of communalism. This is where people are divided on a religious basis, to the extent that today you see holy temples of the Hindus are being bombed. A couple of years ago, shrines of the Muslims were being bombed. And behind all of this violence, all of these bombings, you find the state or the secret services, okay? So in the partition that takes place in India, you not only have the partition of India and Pakistan on a religious basis, that is Hindu, Muslim, and a whole out-migration from India to Pakistan, but then ultimately you have the partition of Bengal, and you have the creation of Bangladesh. And again, it is on this basis. So within India, the rights of the nations, for example, the people of the Punjab in the north part of India are a distinct nation. Now, of course, they also, a large part of them practice the Sikh religion, see? But they are Punjabis. But they have no rights within the Indian constitution, within the Indian framework as Punjabis. And this also extends to the question of languages, right? So you have, like, national language in India is English, which is not known to be a traditional English language. India's law is based on English common law. You referred to human rights. Human rights, whether in India or in Canada, are based on the European tradition of human rights, which emphasize the right of the individual based on property rights. It does not emphasize the right of the collective, which is characteristic of other societies. So what takes place in Palestine is the introduction of Zionism, that is the Zionist settlement of Palestine by the British, the creation of Jewish settlements as a means of dividing the people and setting them at each other's throats so they would not have to deploy 20,000 troops there, which they did not have, okay? So what is followed there in Palestine is a policy like Zionism. It's not simply a race doctrine. It's a doctrine of racial segregation against others. It's a doctrine of racial exclusiveness. And it's a doctrine of racial supremacy, all right? So you spoke, Mike, of negotiations. Between 1921 and 1948, the Palestinians sent 13 delegations to London to negotiate for their rights to land, rights against the settlement, rights to their independence. At the same time, the British would invite the delegations of the Zionists. The Zionists always refused to sit down and negotiate with the Palestinians. In this whole period, from 1921 to 1948, there was not a single negotiation between the Zionists and the Palestinians. because the Zionists did not recognize that the Palestinians existed as a people. They called them Arabs. So we'll negotiate with Syria, we'll negotiate with this prince over here, and so on and so forth. We will not negotiate with you. You people are less than humans. So the right of the people is negated. Okay. Now, in Canada, the same policy was followed. Only in Canada, it was on the basis of language. So we have this myth of two founding nations, in which the nations are characterized on the basis of which language they speak, right? So you do have within Canada, a subjugated nation of Quebec, who speak French, but there is no such thing as a Canadian nation, which exists in 1867, characterized by the fact that they spoke English. The majority languages in 1867 in Canada were the Aboriginal languages, the Quebecois French and Acadian French, Irish and Scottish Gaelic, and English was a fourth language, right? So on this basis of language was one of the important methods of dividing the polity and the people of Canada. And on this basis, today it is characterized that Quebec is not a nation, but a race, or what they call so-called distinct society. So from this perspective, I advocate that Canada needs a new constitution, which is based on enshrining the sovereign rights of the people of Quebec, the sovereign rights of the First Nations, and the fundamental democratic rights, not individual rights, but collective rights of the Canadian people. Now, Mohammed, I want Mohammed just to speak about the role of the question of international law as applies to Palestine and Israel. Because this is a very fundamental question that you have raised, especially today where they say, well, these laws are made to be broken.
Well, the violations for international laws and UN resolutions are almost countless.
You've got to move the camera, please. Move the camera so we can see the speaker.
There's that handsome young fellow.
So as I was saying, the violations are numerous, but more strikingly, we have three violations, which is UN Resolution 181, which is the partition plan of two states, a Palestinian state and an Israeli state that was adopted in 1947. And what it gives is 54% of the historic land of Palestine to the Zionists, which are only 33% of the population of Palestine at the time. And as a matter of fact, back in 1917, there were only, I believe the percentage was 8% Jews in Palestine. So you can see this huge transfer of population, mainly from Russia and Eastern Europe into Palestine. So this resolution itself was unjust for the Palestinians, for the indigenous people. But at the same time, in 1948, when the first Arab-Israeli war happened, Israel occupied about 72% of the land, which was against the resolution, UN Resolution 181. And we have Resolution 194, which calls for the Palestinians' right of return to Palestine. Over 750,000 Palestinians were driven out of their homes either forcibly or they had to flee because of the war conditions in 1948. And the UN passed a resolution calling for their return back to Palestine. It was basically not up to the Israelis or any international power not to force them in exile from their homes. Again, such resolution was abandoned by the Israelis. They never complied. And that brings up Resolution 273, which is the United Nations acceptance of a state, the Israel state, into the membership of the United Nations. However, what's ironic about it is this acceptance is conditioned. The conditions were that they have to comply with Resolution 181 and 194, which Israel is yet to comply with. And technically, or maybe I should say legally, Israel should not be considered part or a member of the United Nations itself. But amazingly, you know, they're being treated as a member of the United Nations, and their violations are still continuing as we speak. And no sanctions, no economic boycotts were endorsed by the United Nations or the international community. And that just shows the Western, mainly the U.S. and Britain, way of colonizing in the Middle East. In this case, it's Palestine. And that's pretty much it, really. Tony?
Can I intervene? Mohammed?
Yes.
Yes. Edward Said has made a major impact, the late Edward Said, a Palestinian-American scholar, who's very critical of the different peace plans that emerged. And one of the observations that he made was that the kind of so-called Palestinian state that that was being contemplated, he compared to Indian reserves in North America or to the so-called Bantustans in South Africa. And of course, the way the settlements break up the West Bank, break up the possibility of contiguous territories, a reasonable amount of territory that you can move around in. But now, of course, the fence of the Wall of Terror simply promotes that process even further. Do you have some thoughts on the comparisons that made between the different types of territories being conceived as Palestinian territory, and the comparison between reserves and Bantustans in South Africa?
Well, certainly. I mean, when speaking of Edward Said, you have to think about his theory of Orientalism, and which explains how the Anglo-Saxon race has continuously dehumanized the Eastern cultures or non-Anglo-Saxon people. And this trend is shown, as you said, here in Canada against the Native Indians in Africa, Asia, throughout Asia, the Middle East. And basically what Edward Said wanted was, his solution was a one-state solution, where both Palestinians and Jews can live together under a kind of the same system of Switzerland, as an example. But the problem is, Zionism is based on alienating and dehumanizing non-Jews. And Zionism, it was made clear right from the start by Ben-Gurion, Herzl, a number of prominent Zionist politicians and figures, that Eretz Israel will expand and will keep on expanding. And the 1948 borders were just a start for the true dream of Eretz Israel,
which is from the Nile to the Lebanon.
Yeah, which supposedly is from the Nile to the Euphrates.
And Litani and Lebanon.
Yeah.
Litani River.
Yeah. And I'm not sure if Tony would like to add something on that.
I think Mike Brewsted would like to get in.
I would like to ask a question to either one of you. you speak of violation and dehumanizing. Whatever supposedly the mother country of to any country or any indigenous or colonized group of people, do you perceive that supposedly, for example, the British monarchy, I often wondered, and my people wondered, if they really knew the plight of Ghana, my tribe, or any tribe in Canada, any First Nation, how they're surviving here. Because I've got a document here, and the author is unknown, and it's quite interesting because, like I say, we had to lobby the members of the British Parliament or House of Lords, and once they caught on that the ideologies or the thought that was being projected from the Canadian government, they started to question that. Is this really true? Because our elders and our lobbyists also brought in the violations of the Indian Act, the Indian Agent, and I don't know if there's Indian agents around the world that, you know, what we had, but the slowly the members of the noble lords started understanding bits and pieces of what we were trying to say. So I guess my question is, do you think that those people that colonized a certain group of people really understand what those colonized people are going through and the violations, whether it's land, culture, those violations, if they really understand the consequences of them? Or is it just a superficial political divide and rule and control, all those things, and yet they never understand the nitty-gritty of those people?
Well, I would sort of ask, why is it important whether or not they understand the consequences of their actions? In other words, every action has an effect. The aim, the intent of the action is also part of the effect. You cannot separate aim and intent from effect, right? So why do you think it is important whether or not they understand the effect when the aim was the effect?
Yeah.
The aim was colonization.
Yeah. I guess so my point here is all of a sudden the lords want to understand the effects of colonization, want to understand what the Canadian government is doing to the First Nations. All of a sudden they want to understand, and all these years is like, well, you know, you're wards of the monarchy. So it became a peculiar situation, you know. It's almost like, well, who should take the blame of the colonized indigenous First Nations? Like, I don't want to use the word buck, but they're trying to find out. It was a very peculiar case in modern times for us, if you understand what my point is.
Yeah, no, it's a good point in this sense that what we're faced with are 19th century political arrangements. 19th century political arrangements which were developed in terms of the needs and interests of the colonizers at that time. And these arrangements are no longer suitable in the modern period of imperialism. but also in the rise of national and social consciousness and so forth. Okay. They understood, but it's like with 19th century also came what was called liberal conscience, right? The other way, or the other way of describing liberal conscience is white man's burden. You see, oh, it's a matter of understanding. You should educate us. We did not understand that this would be the consequence. So they separate aim. And in order to put, you know, carry on with the high ideals of the first colonists, right? The aim of the British in what came to be called Canada, in terms of the First Nations, the solution was in Newfoundland. It was genocide. So Queen Elizabeth was right. The whole native population of Newfoundland, called Beothuks, was wiped out. The First Nations who live now inhabit Newfoundland are Mi'kmaq who have immigrated there over the years. It was the resistance of the First Nations, of which, you know, Tony Hall is very knowledgeable, you're very knowledgeable, which forced the government to basically adopt a form of neocolonialism, which became known as the Indian Act, the treaty system, reserves, to the extent that in the 1980s, they started introducing this phrase, self-government, in which self-government is of the First Nations is not an act of sovereignty, it's an act of what they called the fourth tier of government, mm-hmm. that is of municipal government. So you'll have Indian police, Indian fire department, you know, here we have some Mi'kmaq schools and so forth, right? But you have no sovereignty. You're all based under the Indian Act. Yeah. I'm sorry, Mohammed, you were going to say something? No? Dave? Yeah.
If I could jump in, it's... You're so correct when you say self-government. it's under the existing type of government that's already governing us right now. I guess sovereignty is yet to be achieved. Aboriginal title has yet to be fully, experienced by First Nations, you know. You know, the violations of the Indian Act, the administrative tool in this country, has deteriorated the soul and spirits of our ancestors up to today and possibly into the future. Until we create our own destiny, and we are the government face to face, wherever that's going to be the concept, then that's really, I guess, the beginning of a true sovereign government. As it is now, you are right, the self-government thing is kind of governing ourselves under somebody else's rules. And I'm just wondering, your colleague there, if that's what's happening in, you know, with the Palestinians, what rights can they foresee having in the future?
Go ahead.
One thing is for sure, Palestinians have fought for their self-determination for over 50, 60 years now, and that is one right as human beings, as indigenous people of a land, we should have. I can relate to Native Indians at the same time. You know, their rights, their values, their culture, everything they ever believed in has been invaded by foreigners who basically stole their own culture in terms of fought their values, their cultural values, and so on. And this is what's happening exactly in Palestine, where the Israelis are eradicating the Palestinian culture, eradicating the word Palestine, Palestinians. In every village within the what's so-called Green Line, villages are being demolished. Everything that could relate to a Palestinian history or culture is being eradicated. And the similarities are so unbelievable. The only difference might be is more military applications are being used in the land of Palestine, while a more psychological slash social war has been going on here against the natives.
I want to jump in here, and you raise the issue of military intervention, also psychological intervention. At some point, we have to really grapple with the question of power. Israel has great power because it is heavily armed, because it is, in a sense, impregnable, because it has nuclear weapons. One of the unspoken realities often in the dealing with indigenous peoples in North America is that there isn't power there. There isn't a basis to push back. Although it's interesting that in the Treaty 7, there's a great emphasis or some emphasis on giving ammunition to the Blackfoot. And I see this as a kind of a imperial tactic because the Blackfoot and the Cree are sometimes hostile. So to treat with the Blackfoots separately and then to arm the Blackfoot was a way to intimidate Cree. And of course, Cree are more numerous. This issue of power, I mean, there would be no Canadian nation, there would be no sovereign Canadian nation if it hadn't been for the power of the British Empire, the reality of the British Empire in North America was different than say Latin America, which was much more dominated by the United States, at least in more overt ways. Here it's more cultural ways that Canada is dominated. When we look at what's going on in Iran, and we've discussed the politics of that in this class. There is this building global movement to say Iran must not get nuclear weapons. And yet, on what grounds is it decided who is capable of being trusted with nuclear weapons and who is not being capable, who is not capable of being trusted with nuclear weapons? I mean, it's very interesting when the United States points a finger of condemnation and says, you must not get this kind of weaponry. You must not get this kind of armaments. And yet the United States represents the greatest concentration, the greatest proliferation of weapons of mass destruction that has ever been assembled in the world. So what gives the United States the position to lecture other countries about the problems with building up their military arsenals? So how do we deal with these issues of power? It ultimately comes down to issues of power, does it not?